Welcome, everybody. Good afternoon. My name is Kim Steinbart. I'm one of the managers of Player Health for BCLC, and it's my pleasure today to introduce you to our two speakers. Just a quick housekeeping note, we'll be using Slido. Hopefully everyone's now familiar with Slido, but we'll be using that for Q&A. If you also want to put your hand up and ask in the old-fashioned way, that's also encouraged. So we can use either format. So we have two presenters here today to talk about understanding local access impacts. First is Dr. Khalil Philander. I think everyone's familiar with Khalil, but Khalil's the assistant professor at the School of Hospitality Business Management at Washington State University, an honorary lecturer in the School of Psychology at the University of Sydney. He has a PhD from UNLV and MA in Economics from University of Toronto, and a BCom with honors in Finance from the University of British Columbia. Joining him is Dr. Ray Cho. He's a postdoctoral research associate at the Center for Gambling Studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And Dr. Cho holds an MBA, MS, and PhD, we've covered all the letters, in hospitality from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and earned his BA from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So quite a diverse background, but these two also know each other from back in the Vegas days, so maybe they'll share some stories later. I'm sure there's a few. That's true. And please join me in a warm welcome for Khalil and Ray.
Thank you, Kim, and thank you, everybody, for being... I'm only using the microphone because they're recording it, because it does seem very weird to amplify my voice in a room this size. So today, I'm actually much more excited to be part of this conversation and talk than the former, because this is much more closely connected to the research that I'm actively involved in on a day-to-day basis. And I'm glad that Ray's here, too, because he has... a very unique background, which when I hand the mic over to him, I'll try to tee up a little bit better. But so today, what we're going to do is chat about. Sorry, you would say sorry, but that's such a Canadian thing. we're going to talk about the role of access convenience in generating problems. And there's this line of research I think is really interesting for me because it connects the fields of the business sciences, when we talk about things like access convenience, how close the shopping mall is to the surrounding neighborhood, how easy it is it to find parking, all of these types of things that are really relevant to businesses. And it connects it to the idea of, well, access convenience might also impact the frequency with which people go gamble and the likelihood of them developing gambling problems. Now, I spent some time, let me go through the disclosures here, some of my collaborators from GAMRES, Carleton University, some of the data providers are come from the Statistics Canada Canadian Community Health Survey, and I've collaborated with many government and private organizations over the past 5 years. So this is one of the really interesting charts of the way to think about how access convenience has changed in, this is for Canada, but this is typical of basically every Western nation around the world, where we didn't see anything. I mean, one of my talking points this morning was like the first casino in North America that was licensed and regulated happened in Nevada in 1931. But the second state, which was New Jersey, that didn't happen until the 1970s. So there was a long period where casino gambling was quite constrained to very select markets. So you think about places like Las Vegas, Monte Carlo, again, this is unregulated, but Macau back in the day when it was mostly run by triads, now only partially run by triads. we're recording this, I forgot. and it wasn't until like kind of late 80s throughout the 90s and then 2000s where we started to see more and more jurisdictions expand casino gambling. And part of this was perpetuated by, okay, the state next to us has opened up a casino, now they're attracting all of our residents, so we might as well build one so that at least we're getting our residents back. But in any case, we've seen like this giant burst in the number of casinos. And the hypothesis was, from a health standpoint, is that as we start making these things, occur more often, that we would see a big explosion in the amount of gambling problems in the area. What we actually can kind of see, this is a decade span from 2002 to 2013, 2014. This is very typical of what we would find in other jurisdictions. This is four different provinces in Canada. But generally what we've seen is PGSI scores have dropped, right? So the measure of problem gambling prevalence, despite the fact that we see substantial expansion, we've also, over like similar periods of time, have seen a big drop in the amount of people who have gambling problems. Some of this is conflated and hard to explain because, okay, the way that we measure things as researchers has changed. It's a lot harder to get a hold of people on the phone, right, the way we used to, and it's hard to do those types of studies. What's happened with the reason why I like this data, and I kind of pulled this these kind of very narrow topic, is this is that Canadian Community Health Survey data where they actually sample households and then via randomly sampling households, they'll go in and figure out a very representative sample. And so these are kind of very good apples-to-apples comparisons that it actually has dropped. But if you do look at other studies in other countries or other places, you see a similar thing where it's kind of dropped. Now it's kind of plateaued. And so the question was, okay, does access convenience really matter at all when we're seeing these two trends? And if you think about it for a little bit, there's probably a lot of other very good reasons why prevalence is falling. One, treatment programs have gotten a lot better and they're a lot more widely distributed. And there's been a much stronger focus on making people aware of risks, and responsible gambling programs have significantly expanded. And so part of the research that I did was trying to look at, okay, we do have these things that are conflated, but can we do some studies to actually demonstrate that geography is related to risk before we move on to the next stage? So I did two studies looking at this. So one was a study that we closely controlled for the health and wellness with that that data that I had previously put up. So we looked at things not only like where somebody was situated, but we also looked at things like self-reported health, self-reported mental health, any other clinical disorders that people might have had, and then many other demographic characteristics. The second study was looking at not a representative sample of the population, but looking at active gamblers. So most of the people were at least monthly gamblers. And in that study, we looked at travel time, specifically to their regional casino. So the first, we looked at density, how many casinos are in their health region. The second one, we looked at how many minutes does it actually take them to get to their closest casino. So this is basically a map of what the health regions would look like in British Columbia. So when they report out on COVID-19, health regions that have been affected by people who have tested positive, these are the regions that they're actually talking about. And this is that health survey data that we looked at. So within each health region, I was able to figure out the number of casinos there so we could control for how many people are there per casino in each region, and then control for other health issues that each of these individuals might have. Just to give you some context for how different this data is, on the left, that's the last BC problem gambling prevalence study. On the right, that's another iteration of this study. And the one on the left actually had prevalence study number, I forget the exact number, but I think it was over twice the amount in basically the same year as the one on the right. And so in the context of this apples to apples comparison that I was talking about, it's very important that you have the same methodology when you're actually trying to measure something like prevalence and compare it across time or space. So this was all done with that data on the right. These were the different characteristics that went into it: demographics, overall health. So we had alcohol use, life stress, self-reported health, mental health, which was self-reported, as well as any mood or anxiety disorders. And then our casino measure was casino density. And what we did find with this study was that, of course, all these things that we think are already important that we can control for, demographics, overall health, mental health, they all are important as we expected. But when we control for those things and then we look at casino density, actually having a higher number of casinos per person increases risk. So this kind of counters this individual chart that if I roll back here, where we see here is it looks like things are descending over time. What we actually show there when we control for all of those issues is that risk is higher if there are more casinos near where you live. Okay, so here's the follow-up study. We had 6,000 gamblers. Again, most of them were monthly or more. A large group are casino gamblers, and what I did was I geocoded them based on their postal code of where they lived, and then I geocoded every casino in Canada so that we could calculate, okay, how long would it actually take them to get to a casino. And this was really the model that we were testing. The retail patronage model, that actually comes from the business sciences, not from the health or gambling sciences, but basically says casino access convenience, or just access convenience more generally, is related to how often you'll go. So like if you think about sometimes, you know, you might want to go to a coffee shop, but it's going to be hard to park near there. That's access convenience at work, right? So if it had a nice parking lot or if it had a drive-thru, you'd probably buy one coffee when you might not have if you just didn't have the energy to deal with that mess. And in this context with casinos, what we're testing is, does that visit frequency actually relate to gambling disorder risk? And so this, the whole idea of access convenience back in the day was, how does it actually relate to risk? Because we have all these conflated issues. This is what we were testing. Is it actually just related to going more often? And so what we found is, without, again, nerding it up too much, is that it does matter a lot. So if you live closer, you'll visit a lot more often. And if you visit more often, you're going to have a higher risk of developing a gambling disorder. So that black line says, how likely are you to never go to a casino? And you can see the longer the travel time, the more likely it is that you'll never, ever go to a casino. And at about the two-hour point, that's when we actually really see a big drop in the likelihood that you would go. And then in terms of how does this translate to risk, we can see that as long as you're less than monthly on the bottom there, you're pretty close in terms of those confidence intervals. Those are the bars that go up and down. You're pretty close to like where you would be with never going. But we see a big spike at the kind of monthly or more point, and then we see another kind of spike at the more than weekly point. So when I've had these conversations with regulators in Singapore who have this program where you have to pay, if you're a local, you have to pay every time you want to go into the casino, or you can buy an annual pass that'll let you go as often as you want. And I said, well, I don't love that policy in general just because I don't know if it works. It's kind of weird. But this is a way that you could think about how you would restructure that. So maybe you don't actually charge people if they don't go more than once a month. But once they get above once a month, that's when you would start to charge them more. And I don't know if that creates the right incentives because, you know, people who have a gambling disorder might still behave irrationally, but at least as far as the risk level, that might be a smarter way of structuring the tax so that at least people who have very low risk are more likely to go and aren't just getting scared off by the fact that they would have to pay an entry fee. So just to summarize this part of the talk, what do we know? So prevalence rates are falling, but this probably has more to do with the treatment and prevention programs that, you know, everybody in this room at this conference is involved in some way, shape, or form. And casino access does seem to matter in some way, but to understand that impact, we have to control for a lot of different elements. So in our model with gamblers, yeah, at the two-hour commute mark, we see that players are much more likely to be multiple time a year gamblers than the once a year gamblers that are basically no risk. So I'm going to pass this microphone over to Ray, and I just want to say one thing that's very interesting about Ray's background. So we met at UNLV, and Ray is now in the School of Social Work at Rutgers University, but spent a large part of his career working in the gambling industry, heading up an analytics department within a major operator there. So he is somebody that's well-versed in a lot of the modeling side of the business, but is now looking at things from a different perspective. So we're very lucky to have Ray here, and I'll just pass the microphone over to him.
Actually, hold on. I'm going to walk over to the podium, actually. That's still okay, right?
Hello?
Thanks, Khalil, and thank you to everyone for being here. It's really amazing what I've been able to learn and pick up. And to Khalil's point, I'm a bit of a rookie. I spent a good portion of my career in the industry, and I'm kind of coming over to social work, you know. So I'm going to actually kind of contrast that a little bit. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about an industry perspective of how they look at new markets and strategize geographically. So I'll wear one hat, and it'll be a little bit of an MBA businessy hat. You can call it the dark side if you'd like. That's fair. I will switch on to more of a research academic hat, and we'll kind of converge back towards that. So how the industry approaches sort of new market feasibility. So, you know, Khalil mentioned geography. You know, we say, oh, what's the new opportune market? So one of the first things I want to help you understand is there's something that we do in industry. I'm going to say we right now as an industry, okay? So I'll switch over. I'll let you know when that hat change actually happens. So before we as an industry purchase a new property or acquire a new property, we often do something that's called a feasibility study. These studies have been around for some time. This gentleman, Rushmore, he actually started a consulting company called HVS, Hotel Valuation Services, which actually evaluate and look at hotel projects. This actually was something that sort of came about during the expansion of the motel business model in the 50s and 60s of the U.S. to say, hey, you know, we're moving to cars, we're driving across country, people want to stay places, let's build these real estate projects. How much are these things worth? How much can we look to make? And what's sort of the ROI in these sorts of projects? So very sort of innocent sort of backgrounds. And when you look at a feasibility study, you'll see things like a site review and what is the size of the plot and the topography, what is the neighborhood like, what kind of access and visibility, what kind of hotel amenities will there be, what kind of services will there be, what kind of plot of land, how much infrastructure is there, these are the sorts of things that help us inform the decision of, you know, how much money do I have to put into this before, you know, I can turn into this? Do I have to renovate this, or am I going to upgrade the facility? And then we look at the market area and the demographics to kind of say, hey, what's the local business going to be like? What are the feeder markets going to be like? And that helps us kind of define that market and the population. But we're just going to use this and now do this to casinos, right? Does that work? What about gaming? As you are probably familiar with, the revenue streams of a hotel without a casino is going to look a lot different than a income statement of a resort with gaming. So when I was working in the private sector, one of the projects or the sites that we're looking at, and I'm going to kind of walk you through this case in Biloxi, Mississippi, which is west of New Orleans area, so it's a coastal community. And I didn't divulge exactly where the site is, but we use this to see what is the, Khalil used the term like prevalence or accessibility. We're going to say, what is the competitive landscape? That's what we say, right? So we take a look, and we have all these different casino corporations, operators in this area, and we're going to build it. So if we build it, what is this going to look like? We're not really concerned that there is access. In fact, we're going to say maybe they have enough access there, and if we build it, we will only get a small share of that pie. So this is kind of how we start looking at that 30,000-foot level. Then we say, okay, well, if we build it, what kind of property is it going to be? Is it going to be a locals casino? Is it going to be a regional casino? Or is it going to be a destination casino? And do we all know what we mean by that? Are people from the neighborhood going to be going there? Are people going to be driving into the market? Or are people going to be flying into the market and going maybe once a year versus going once a week, you know, this frequency sort of thing? So we look at what properties we have in our own corporate portfolio, and we say, hey, we have a local property, a regional property, and destination property, and we know the percentage of customers come from the locals or the drive market or the destination. And these were set by the corporation
at the 0 to 50 mile, 50 to 250 mile, 250 plus mile. So you can kind of see, you know, for a local's property, 68% come from that market, and 93% of that revenue is generated by that market. Whereas on the destination, you kind of see it flip a little bit, where you're not getting a lot of locals. In Vegas, as locals, we don't go often into the Strip. You know, it's like New Yorkers don't go to Times Square, something like that, right?
Okay.
So this kind of helps us to see, hey, what does the Biloxi market look like? Can we start to project revenues and understand our market more accurately based on something that we have? So this is kind of how the casino executive is thinking. And what we have access to is our own revenues, as well as, you know, generally in the United States with gaming markets, you can look at kind of the regional gross gaming revenue. So you can start to study the shape of the seasonality and things like that. So in addition to looking at the market and the demographic characteristics, we can also start to see, hey, what does the seasonality of revenue look like? Can we start to make a more accurate prediction because, you know, a certain revenue in the new market that we might enter looks somewhat close. We have some similar humps maybe in March and October that we start to say, and this is the closest thing that we had. So we can start to say, hey, you know, this is starting to look like the property that we have in our regional market, okay? This regional market property that we had also existed on a waterfront near a river. So we're like, oh, and we looked at the income and we're like, okay, this seems comparable. So that is kind of what we started to do internally. Okay. So from that, we can start to do some revenue projections. Hey, if we buy this property and we build a casino or we renovate a casino, let's start projecting out how much we could make or how long it would be before we, you know, get our return on investment. But, you know, we talked, one of the themes of this conference is future-proofing. But future is a nice, lofty word. But what do we mean by the future? Should we project out 5 years, 10 years, 15, 30? What do we consider, you know, a healthy future? And these feasibility reports, they vary based on many factors. And I'm going to continue to come back to that point. In this study, we did a five-year one because we could say, oh, well, we don't want to project further out because, you know, the market is so volatile. You know, we don't want to make too many forward-looking statements or something like that. Okay. But in, like, if you, do you guys know that Japan is looking at integrated resorts? So that would be like a 30-year license. So, you know, they might project out far longer. So you could do different things based on kind of what your goals are or how invested you are in the future, not of the community, but of your investment. So those are somewhat kind of different things. Okay. So now that we can kind of see, hey, let's project out these revenues, you know, we're pretty good at what we do. Why don't we add a 2% compounded annual growth rate on top of that? We put that in front of our investors. Isn't this a great project? Should we do this? Should we not? Okay. So one of the criticisms of feasibility studies is a lot of these things are designed to just say kind of what you want, right? I mean, we pay someone that's not us to just say, I want to build this, so go make it say that. I mean, we know that a lot of feasibility studies were done in the fall of 2008, but none of those worked out, right? So. But the exercise is there where we can get our gross gaming revenue. We can get how many slot positions there are. We get the win per unit at that level, extrapolate what we see in our own properties, and then kind of apply that to the new thing, how many gaming positions we are. Then apply that seasonality to it, a growth rate, and then we kind of get some baseline level financial projections on gaming. With hotel, how big is the hotel going to be? 200-room property, average daily rate. Are we going to put ourselves at the 3-star level, 4-star level? Let's say 3 stars, average daily rate of about $60, occupancy at maybe 70, 80% throughout the year. Now you're starting to get, you know, multiply that by whatever, and then you can get a hotel revenue. And you can do the same with the meeting space, okay, and the non-gaming business as well, like restaurants. And then you're starting to, you could get even more in-depth and break apart your business by how many people will be business and convention goers versus sort of leisure segments. And this is all set, this is kind of top line, we call this top line analysis of Where are we getting our money from? And then we can project that into financial analysis, because now we're getting into income against expenses. So now we're starting to look pretty legit in terms of, like, hey, this is a viable project. It's a feasible project. And I've seen other corporations as well as outside consultants do other types of things. We often see something called a gravity model. It happens a lot in the social sciences. Anything that says, hey, you build something and it's going to start to attract business in a similar way that gravity acts. And, you know, I've seen tourism gravity models where, okay, we have you're predicting like it's going to be the same amount of tourism, but maybe you build the largest resort that this place has ever seen, and now that changes the entire landscape of the community. So if you build Disneyland, like, that will then become the reason. So this is like induced tourism, right? Are we adding an incremental level? Okay. And I've seen them get a little bit more sophisticated. You'll see some income inequality analysis. Even a Gini index has been applied to some of these things. You could pay a company just to do a population and economic overview, multi-level competitive analysis, primary feeder markets, secondary feeder markets. So you can really, basically, I like to think of it as you can make a crystal ball as fancy as you want it to be, right? So you can have a base one, or you could pay a consulting company more to have all these additional layers on it. But at the end of the day, it's still a crystal ball. So, and then regional development pipeline, if it's a hot market, you know that other people will be coming on board. You have to account for new projects kind of going into the model, so that's going to affect your sort of share of market that you'd be tapping into. Are we starting to get the hang of how we're doing this and strategizing markets? Okay. So now I'm going to switch hats and put on a researcher hat. And I'm asking the question to myself and to the group, which is, are there any situations where too much growth could actually be a bad thing for our business? Okay, and that you don't really see in feasibility studies. It was never intended to sort of put these things in here. And it's not the best, easiest sell to say, hey, you should do this project. Having said that, you might completely fleece the town and we'll all lose our money. But maybe they should be, okay? So, you know, a boomtown, we typically associate that word with, like, big oil or natural resources and things like that, and they happen in remote locations. But we can see that also happening in the gaming industry as well. And what happens is, you know, what is the sentiment of the locals who are living there versus all of a sudden these people come in and move in and work and spend the money, and that's kind of what can happen in a boomtown. If you're familiar with the oil and gas of the types of workers that brings in and the types of markets they feed, it can be a little unsavory sometimes. But that can also happen in the gaming industry, as we saw in Cambodia here. They had rapid growth very quickly by Chinese investors, and in a period of, you know, 2 decades, it went from a nice quiet community to just overrun and, you know, being run by the Chinese mafia. Like, that's not unheard of. You know, the locals felt completely displaced. So, and then a lot of people lost money on that investment. So, in a sense, the industry doesn't necessarily know it at the time, but they may be interested in these types of concerns, even though that doesn't traditionally show up in feasibility studies. I'm going to try to pick a casino or a Canadian example here. So this was a study done in Ontario, in Elora. I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. And they looked at that community and the Grand River Racetrack. They wanted to institute slots and table games into that. So, you know, there was a concern about, well, what's that going to do to our identity of place, our heritage, and our connection to the natural landscape? Does implementing a casino affect that? And that would be interesting to, I'd say, business interests as well, because if you disrupt something, then that might affect your business for positive or negative. It could be informative to know those sorts of things. And they, at least in this article, They discussed a couple factors that helped to make the casino implement it. It was approved, but they made sure that it was placed in a certain part of the building, that the public policy, the image of the tourism was well maintained, and that the visuals kind of what you see when you go there is not really about the casino. It's kind of this thing that's kind of hidden off to the side, and we're going to downplay it. So, and that's of interest to companies in terms of how do we message and market this for the maximum effect, but at the same time being respectful to the market that we're entering. So I think these sorts of things could start to be interwoven. We've talked a little bit about remote locations, but when you're talking about urban areas, then you're going to get things like gentrification concerns. This study looked at a town in Philadelphia, and they found that the long-term residents had a different sort of feeling about, casinos entering than the new residents. The new residents, surprisingly, were actually against it, and they said, hey, this is going to be a threat to vulnerable populations and it might introduce crime, whereas the long-term residents were like, actually, we need this. We kind of need some economic development, and we've been here for longer, and it would be nice if we were a part of this. So you see that tension as well. And the framework in this study was, Lefebvre's right to the city concept, which is who should rightfully have the power to make a community, which is, we talk about the word stakeholder a lot, and who are these stakeholders? When we talk about risk and weighing these sorts of costs, Edington's work is, very instrumental here. But the benefits are easier to measure than the costs, as Walker noted. How else can you sort of manage this risk? Well, you can bundle it with other products. Hey, we're not just building a casino, we're also building a theme park and these sorts of things. So that's another way that corporations can kind of manage this risk as well. And the sort of where the sausage is made reality of this whole thing is, what a lot of times these deals come down to the deal itself. They talk a good game, the industry, about including stakeholders and whatnot, but it's really like, can I just get a good deal? What is the licensing agreement? How much tax am I getting? How deep am I in this? Am I going to get any stock out of this? How much of that is, what kind of stocks? Am I going to have an operating interest or not? Those are really sort of what's going on in the back rooms. Meanwhile, their PR people are saying, yes, we want to create jobs and we'll be invested in the community. I'm not saying that those things are insincere, but when you look at the dynamics of how these things get decided, a lot of that can come down to the sort of the capital structure of these deals, which goes back to kind of that 5, 10, 15, 20, 30-year thing. How long are these operators actually invested in those communities? Because a deal could be attractive if I know I'm going to leave that community in 5 years. And I just need to say what I have to say to get that deal done. So that might be the best deal from a financial standpoint, but is it really the best deal for the community? So the community could be sort of swayed into thinking that this is going to do all these great things, and then the operator moves in, and then they sell off the property in, a short amount of time. So at the moment, we, as a society, could be sort of duped into thinking that this was a good deal, and that certainly can happen. So when we look at the, how these things collaborate, the fit between the community and the operators is something that we don't really talk about or address in feasibility studies or community studies of that nature. So how are we doing here? So some of the things that we're looking at in my current research is we look at, the stakeholder approach. So we say, hey, we're all stakeholders in this. But who is a stakeholder and who is a non-stakeholder when it comes to this? Because a vulnerable population, are they really a stakeholder in a
Welcome, everybody. Good afternoon. My name is Kim Steinbart. I'm one of the managers of Player Health for BCLC, and it's my pleasure today to introduce you to our two speakers. Just a quick housekeeping note, we'll be using Slido. Hopefully everyone's now familiar with Slido, but we'll be using that for Q&A. If you also want to put your hand up and ask in the old-fashioned way, that's also encouraged. So we can use either format. So we have two presenters here today to talk about understanding local access impacts. First is Dr. Khalil Philander. I think everyone's familiar with Khalil, but Khalil's the assistant professor at the School of Hospitality Business Management at Washington State University and honorary lecturer in the School of Psychology at the University of Sydney. He has a PhD from UNLV and MA in Economics from University of Toronto and a BCom with honors in finance from the University of British Columbia. Joining him is Dr. Ray Cho. He's a postdoctoral research associate at the Center for Gambling Studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And Dr. Cho holds an MBA, MS, and PhD, we've covered all the letters, in hospitality from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and earned his BA from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So quite a diverse background, but these two also know each other from back in the Vegas days, so maybe they'll share some stories later. I'm sure there's a few. That's true. And please join me in a warm welcome for Khalil and Ray.
Thank you, Kim, and thank you, everybody, for being... I'm only using the microphone because they're recording it, because it does seem very weird to amplify my voice in a room this size. So today, I'm actually much more excited to be part of this conversation and talk than the former, because this is much more closely connected to the research that I'm actively involved in on a day-to-day basis. And I'm glad that Ray's here, too, because he has... a very unique background, which when I hand the mic over to him, I'll try to tee up a little bit better. But so today, what we're going to do is chat about. I swear you would say sorry, but that's such a Canadian thing. we're going to talk about the role of access convenience in generating problems. And there's this line of research I think is really interesting for me because it connects the fields of the business sciences, when we talk about things like access convenience, how close the shopping mall is to the surrounding neighborhood, how easy it is it to find parking, all of these types of things that are really relevant to businesses. And it connects it to the idea of, well, access convenience might also impact the frequency with which people go gamble and the likelihood of them developing gambling problems. Now, I spent some time, let me go through the disclosures here, some of my collaborators from GAMRES, Carleton University, some of the data providers come from the Statistics Canada Canadian Community Health Survey, and I've collaborated with many government and private organizations over the past 5 years. So this is one of the really interesting charts of the way to think about how access convenience has changed in, this is for Canada, but this is typical of basically every Western nation around the world, where we didn't see anything. I mean, one of my talking points this morning was like the first casino in North America that was licensed and regulated happened in Nevada in 1931. But the second state, which was New Jersey, that didn't happen until the 1970s. So there was a long period where casino gambling was quite constrained to very select markets. So you think about places like Las Vegas, Monte Carlo, again, this is unregulated, but Macau back in the day when it was mostly run by triads, now only partially run by triads. we're recording this, I forgot. and it wasn't until like kind of late 80s throughout the 90s and then 2000s where we started to see more and more jurisdictions expand casino gambling. And part of this was perpetuated by, okay, the state next to us has opened up a casino, now they're attracting all of our residents, so we might as well build one so that at least we're getting our residents back. But in any case, we've seen like this giant burst in the number of casinos. And the hypothesis was, from a health standpoint, is that as we start making these things, occur more often, that we would see a big explosion in the amount of gambling problems in the area. What we actually can kind of see, this is a decade span from 2002 to 2013, 2014. This is very typical of what we would find in other jurisdictions. This is four different provinces in Canada. But generally what we've seen is PGSI scores have dropped, right? So the measure of problem gambling prevalence, despite the fact that we see substantial expansion, we've also, over like similar periods of time, have seen a big drop in the amount of people who have gambling problems. Some of this is conflated and hard to explain because, okay, the way that we measure things as researchers has changed. It's a lot harder to get a hold of people on the phone, right, the way we used to, and it's hard to do those types of studies. What's happened with the reason why I like this data, and I kind of pulled this these kind of very narrow topic, is this is that Canadian Community Health Survey data where they actually sample households and then via randomly sampling households, they'll go in and figure out a very representative sample. And so these are kind of very good apples-to-apples comparisons that it actually has dropped. But if you do look at other studies in other countries or other places, you see a similar thing where it's kind of dropped. Now it's kind of plateaued. And so the question was, okay, does access convenience really matter at all when we're seeing these two trends? And if you think about it for a little bit, there's probably a lot of other very good reasons why prevalence is falling. One, treatment programs have gotten a lot better and they're a lot more widely distributed. And there's been a much stronger focus on making people aware of risks, and responsible gambling programs have significantly expanded. And so part of the research that I did was trying to look at, okay, we do have these things that are conflated, but can we do some studies to actually demonstrate that geography is related to risk before we move on to the next stage? So I did two studies looking at this. So one was a study that we closely controlled for the health and wellness with that data that I had previously put up. So we looked at things not only like where somebody was situated, but we also looked at things like self-reported health, self-reported mental health, any other clinical disorders that people might have had, and then many other demographic characteristics. The second study was looking at not a representative sample of the population, but looking at active gamblers. So most of the people were at least monthly gamblers. And in that study, we looked at travel time, specifically to their regional casino. So the first, we looked at density, how many casinos are in their health region. The second one, we looked at how many minutes does it actually take them to get to their closest casino. So so this is basically a map of what the health regions would look like in British Columbia. So when they report out on COVID-19 health regions that have been affected by people who have tested positive, these are the regions that they're actually talking about. And this is that health survey data that we looked at. So within each health region, I was able to figure out the number of casinos there so we could control for how many people are there per casino in each region, and then control for other health issues that each of these individuals might have. And so just to give you some context for how different this data is, on the left, that's the last BC problem gambling prevalence study. On the right, that's another iteration of this study. And the one on the left actually had prevalence study number, I forget the exact number, but I think it was over twice the amount in basically the same year as the one on the right. And so in the context of this apples-to-apples comparison that I was talking about, it's very important that you have the same methodology when you're actually trying to measure something like prevalence and compare it across time or space. So this was all done with that data on the right. And so these were the different characteristics that went into it: demographics, overall health. So we had alcohol use, life stress, self-reported health, mental health, which was self-reported, as well as any mood or anxiety disorders. And then our casino measure was casino density. And what we did find with this study was that, of course, all these things that we think are already important that we can control for, demographics, overall health, mental health, they all are important as we expected. But when we control for those things and then we look at casino density, actually having a higher number of casinos per person increases risk. So this kind of counters this individual chart that if I roll back here, where we see here is it looks like things are descending over time. What we actually show there when we control for all of those issues is that risk is higher if there are more casinos near where you live. Okay, so here's the follow-up study. We had 6,000 gamblers. Again, most of them were monthly or more. A large group are casino gamblers, and what I did was I geocoded them based on their postal code of where they lived, and then I geocoded every casino in Canada so that we could calculate, okay, how long would it actually take them to get to a casino. And this was really the model that we were testing. The retail patronage model, that actually comes from the business sciences, not from the health or gambling sciences, but basically says casino access convenience, or just access convenience more generally, is related to how often you'll go. So like if you think about sometimes, you know, you might want to go to a coffee shop, but it's going to be hard to park near there. That's access convenience at work, right? So if it had a nice parking lot or if it had a drive-through, you'd probably buy one coffee when you might not have if you just didn't have the energy to deal with that mess. And in this context with casinos, what we're testing is, does that visit frequency actually relate to gambling disorder risk? And so this, the whole idea of access convenience back in the day was, how does it actually relate to risk? Because we have all these conflated issues. This is what we were testing. Is it actually just related to going more often? And so what we found is, without, again, nerding it up too much, is that it does matter a lot. So if you live closer, you'll visit a lot more often. And if you visit more often, you're going to have a higher risk of developing a gambling disorder. So that black line says, how likely are you to never go to a casino? And you can see the longer the travel time, the more likely it is that you'll never, ever go to a casino. And at about the two-hour point, that's when we actually really see a big drop in the likelihood that you would go. And then in terms of how does this translate to risk, we can see that as long as you're less than monthly on the bottom there, you're pretty close in terms of those confidence intervals. Those are the bars that go up and down. You're pretty close to like where you would be with never going. But we see a big spike at the kind of monthly or more point, and then we see another kind of spike at the more than weekly point. So when I've had these conversations with regulators in Singapore who have this program where you have to pay, if you're a local, you have to pay every time you want to go into the casino, or you can buy an annual pass that'll let you go as often as you want. And I said, well, I don't love that policy in general just because I don't know if it works. It's kind of weird. But this is a way that you could think about how you would restructure that. So maybe you don't actually charge people if they don't go more than once a month. But once they get above once a month, that's when you would start to charge them more. And I don't know if that creates the right incentives because, you know, people who have a gambling disorder might still behave irrationally, but at least as far as the risk level, that might be a smarter way of structuring the tax so that at least people who have very low risk are more likely to go and aren't just getting scared off by the fact that they would have to pay an entry fee. So just to summarize this part of the talk, what do we know? So prevalence rates are falling, but this probably has more to do with the treatment and prevention programs that, you know, everybody in this room at this conference is involved in some way, shape, or form. And casino access does seem to matter in some way, but to understand that impact, we have to control for a lot of different elements. So in our model with gamblers, yeah, at the two-hour commute mark, we see that players are much more likely to be multiple time of year gamblers than the once a year gamblers that are basically no risk. So I'm going to pass this microphone over to Ray, and I just want to say one thing that's very interesting about Ray's background. So we met at UNLV, and Ray is now in the School of Social Work at Rutgers University, but spent a large part of his career working in the gambling industry, heading up an analytics department within a major operator there. So he is somebody that's well-versed in a lot of the modeling side of the business, but is now looking at things from a different perspective. So we're very lucky to have Ray here, and I'll just pass the microphone over to him.
Actually, hold on. I'm going to walk over to the podium, actually. That's still okay, right?
Hello? Thanks, Khalil, and thank you to everyone for being here. It's really amazing what I've been able to learn and pick up. And to Khalil's point, I'm a bit of a rookie. I spent a good portion of my career in the industry and kind of coming over to social work, you know. So I'm going to actually kind of contrast that a little bit. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about an industry perspective of how they look at new markets and strategize geographically. So I'll wear one hat, and it'll be a little bit of an MBA businessy hat. You can call it the dark side if you'd like. That's fair. I will switch on to more of a research academic hat, and we'll kind of kind of converge back towards that. So how the industry approaches sort of new market feasibility. So, you know, Khalil mentioned geography. You know, we say, oh, what's the new opportune market? So one of the first things I want to help you understand is there's something that we do in industry. I'm going to say we right now as an industry, okay? So I'll switch over. I'll let you know when that hat change actually happens. So before we as an industry purchase a new property or acquire a new property, we often do something that's called a feasibility study. These studies have been around for some time. This gentleman, Rushmore, he actually started a consulting company called HVS, Hotel Valuation Services, which actually evaluate and look at hotel projects. This actually was something that sort of came about during the expansion of the motel business model in the 50s and 60s of the U.S. to say, hey, you know, we're moving to cars, we're driving across country, people want to stay places, let's build these real estate projects. How much are these things worth? How much can we look to make? And what's sort of the ROI in these sorts of projects? So very sort of innocent sort of backgrounds. And when you look at a feasibility study, you'll see things like a site review and what is the size of the plot and the topography, what is the neighborhood like, what kind of access and visibility, what kind of hotel amenities will there be, what kind of services will there be, what kind of plot of land, how much infrastructure is there plumbing, these are the sorts of things that help us inform the decision of, you know, how much money do I have to put into this before, you know, I can turn into this? Do I have to renovate this, or am I going to upgrade the facility? And then we look at the market area and the demographics to kind of say, hey, what's the local business going to be like? What are the feeder markets going to be like? And that helps us kind of define that market and the population. But we're just going to use this and now do this to casinos, right? Does that work? What about gaming? As you are probably familiar with, the revenue streams of a hotel without a casino is going to look a lot different than a income statement of a resort with gaming. So when I was working in the private sector, one of the projects or the sites that we were looking at, and I'm going to kind of walk you through this case in Biloxi, Mississippi, which is west of New Orleans area, so it's a coastal community. And I didn't divulge exactly where the site is, but we use this to see what is the, Khalil used the term like prevalence or accessibility. We're going to say, what is the competitive landscape? That's what we say, right? So we take a look, and we have all these different casino corporations, operators in this area, and we're going to build it. So if we build it, what is this going to look like? We're not really concerned that there is access. In fact, we're going to say maybe they have enough access there, and if we build it, we will only get a small share of that pie. So this is kind of how we start looking at that 30,000-foot level. Then we say, okay, well, if we build it, what kind of property is it going to be? Is it going to be a locals casino? Is it going to be a regional casino? Or is it going to be a destination casino? And do we all know what we mean by that? Are people from the neighborhood going to be going there? Are people going to be driving into the market? Or are people going to be flying into the market and going maybe once a year versus going once a week, this frequency sort of thing? So we look at what properties we have in our own corporate portfolio, and we say, hey, we have a local property, a regional property, and destination property, and we know the percentage of customers come from the locals or the drive market or the destination. And these were set by the corporation at the 0 to 50 mile, 50 to 250 mile, 250 plus mile. So you can kind of see, you know, for a local's property, 68% come from that market, and 93% of that revenue is generated by that market. Whereas on the destination, you can kind of see it flip a little bit, where you're not getting a lot of locals. In Vegas, as locals, we don't go often into the Strip. You know, it's like New Yorkers don't go to Times Square, something like that, right?
Okay.
So this kind of helps us to see, hey, what does the Biloxi market look like? Can we start to project revenues and understand our market more accurately based on something that we have? So this is kind of how the casino executive is thinking. And what we have access to is our own revenues, as well